is quite what they have in mind as a hobby for me, but they are happy I want to engage in something, worried that I have already become a lost soul. An accordion is expensive. So they go to my sister Pam. Our parents came to me privately. Here I am, 10 years old, and they say, Bruce isn't doing well in school. He has this interest in playing the accordion, and we want to encourage that because he needs to be successful in something. I could see this coming. Christmas is right around the corner, and they said, you know, things are tight financially, so we're wondering if you would not totally give up your Christmas, but no big present for you this year, because we need to spend several hundred dollars on this accordion. I was first born. I never did anything wrong. But inside I'm saying, hell no. But what I said to them is, okay. To this day, I hate the sound of the accordion. To me, it's like fingernails on the blackboard, and I had to listen to him practice. It is painful at first. Every sound like somebody wheezing to death. I have a fine teacher. I keep at it. I give a mean concert recital in my Cub Scout uniform. It is a pivotal moment, a glimpse that I can achieve something if I put my mind to it, actually be good at something. But rock and roll is beginning to take hold in the late 50s and early 60s. Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Chuck Berry and, of course, the Beatles. None of them would be caught dead with the accordion. Here I am, playing oompa music, with a possible career on the polka party circuit. It gets to the point where I am afraid to tell anyone I play the accordion for fear it will just become another source of ridicule. So I quit. As I said, there is a reason for everything in life. The hand of God takes you in directions you never consider, even when it involves the accordion. Looking back, I am happy I played it instead of the guitar. Had I chosen the guitar because of its cool factor, my guess is that I would have tried to get as good as I possibly could and would have become consumed with it at least through high school. I would have made it my calling card. By giving up the accordion and concluding that a life in music was not for me, I was forced to find another outlet, the one that saved my life. June 13, 2015. I was living in La La Land. I am walking up to the front door of a home in Vista, California. I am meeting with a mother and father whose teenage transgender son killed himself because of harassment and bullying on social media and in school, combined with severe depression. I am trying to imagine the torment the teenager was in, but I cannot. He was 14 years old. 14. I am trying to imagine the pain of the parents and his sister, but I cannot. I was admittedly living in La La Land the first few months after transition. I was in such euphoria becoming Caitlin that the massive problems facing our community really did not register. I began to read studies, but statistics only show. They do not tell. It is only when you look into the eyes of a mother whose transgender son committed suicide, listen to her ask what she could have done differently when there was nothing she could have done, that you begin to understand how becoming a trans person affects not just the individual, but the entire family. The age of the person transitioning doesn't matter, because tragedy can happen at any age. What does matter is that for all the raising of public consciousness, there is still a marathon to be run, and I don't think it will be finished in my lifetime. I need to listen to those who have been so terribly impacted. I need to say I am sorry, although the word has such little meaning. I need to shed tears of my own. It renews my commitment to change. Which is what brings me to the front door of the home in Vista. I am greeted by Catherine and Carl Prescott. It was their son Kyler who took his own life in the bathroom of the family's home on May 18, 2015. According to his mom, it wasn't just depression and repeated cyberbullying that made life such hell for him. It was also adults who refused to accept Kyler or address Kyler by the correct pronoun, even though he had legally changed his name and his gender marker. I worry about transgender teens the most, although I am buoyed by the number of programs for gender-variant, gender-nonconforming, and transgender children and youth that I have made a point of seeing all over the country. But I still worry. Statistics are useful. In a recent study, 51% of transgender youth reported thinking about suicide, and 30% said they had attempted it. There has historically been a lack of acceptance of the LGBTQ community, and this has only been amplified by cyberbullying. Today, it's even more awful than a group of kids in the school hallway gossiping about someone, because hurtful and malicious words posted online by cowards who hide behind the internet never go away. By way of example, all you have to do is go on my Instagram account and see the comments to understand the level of vicious hate that is out there. When I write something positive about the trans community, I am met with comments beyond comprehension by transphobics, homophobics, and racists. Kyler had tremendous courage, but courage is not enough. There has to be tolerance initiated by adults. The instant there is any cyberbullying on a social networking site, it is incumbent upon the powers that be to not only immediately remove the posts, but also ban the users. This is not an issue of free speech. This is an issue of freedom of choice and self-expression, and potentially preventing suicide. There is nothing more painful than losing your child. Nothing, said Catherine Prescott in an interview with the New York Daily News. Kyler was the sweetest, gentlest human being. He wouldn't hurt a fly. The only thing on earth he would hurt is himself. And if I can even help one family, one other transgender kid like Kyler, I will do it, because this has to stop. Catherine Prescott shows me pictures of Kyler. She tells me of his love playing the piano. She lets me read a poem Kyler wrote about transitioning. She talks with passion and beauty, something you can only feel when you are on the front lines. I feel like I did everything possible to embrace his gender identity, but my child committed suicide anyway, and I've struggled with the unfairness of that. I joined the family and Kyler's friends at a memorial service at a nearby beach, where balloons are released in his memory. The kids ask me questions, as they have in other settings from Dubuque to Brooklyn to San Francisco. I answer all of them as best as I can, telling them that whatever their struggles are, they do get better. Maybe it sounds trite, but I sincerely believe it, as long as kids have love and support. We have to do better. I have to do better. Hanging out at an Oscar party with Lady Gaga is nice, and I truly appreciate her public support of my transition. Hanging out in private with kids needing support is more rewarding. Last year, I gave out my cell number at church to a teenager struggling with gender dysphoria and communicating with parents who had trouble dealing with it. I told him to call or text me, and he does. I met at my house for several hours with a mother and her trans teen daughter who had flown out from New Jersey. I invited a trans woman I have gotten to know named Ella, who transitioned as a senior in high school only a few years earlier. I wanted the daughter to see that Ella came out thriving on the other side, and now the two of them follow each other on social media. As a parent, I also can identify with the fears of the mom, not simply in terms of acceptance of her daughter in school and the community, but the impact transition had on their own relationship. I remember someone asking me one day how I would handle it if one of my children had transitioned as a teenager. Despite my own transition, I know I would have had anxiety, this feeling of my daughter or son becoming someone I no longer know. But no matter how difficult it would be for me, I would never stand in the way of any of my children. The mom felt relief when I related to her that her fears are common for any parent. I've received thousands of letters. Many thank me for going public with my story and how it inspired them to transition. Some have told me they were contemplating suicide and decided not to because of my willingness to be so open. About a year ago, I was connected to a transgender woman from South Dakota who was convinced she would not be able to find work because of the climate of the state. Legislation restricting bathroom use in schools by transgender teens was passed until a veto by the governor. Other anti-LGBTQ legislation had been proposed as well. She was right to think the atmosphere was toxic. Nobody will hire me. We spoke on the phone at least a dozen times. I asked her what her interests were, and she said she loved doing makeup. Because of my association with MAC Cosmetics, I told her to see if there was a retail store in the state, and I would call the company to make sure she got hired. There wasn't one, so I urged her to try a department store. She was terrified when she went in to apply. She got a job and afterward sent me a video of her crying. She was so joyful. None of this makes me remotely special, only human. Focusing on the issues is enormously important. But when I first met with the trans women who would become a part of my reality television show on E! I Am Kate, and talked about all the lives we had to save, I remember Shandy Moore saying something I will never forget. Shandy has spent years working with trans and gender nonconforming kids at Children's Hospital Los Angeles in the program Brave Leaders Unified to Strengthen Our Health, Blush. As I was talking, she interrupted me, which is typical of Shandy when there is something that needs to be said. You can't save every soul, but you can save one soul at a time. It sunk in that you can talk about the big issues as much as you want, and that's important, but you also have to go one-on-one on a personal level. I can only do so much. I obviously cannot prevent every suicide as much as I wish I could. But I also know how crucial it is to reach out to individuals, which is why I do it. I hope others in a position to do the same will reach out as well. If we all save one soul at a time, then collectively we will save thousands. I watch those balloons released into the sky on that strip of beach. I leave feeling not just sadness, but anger that this could have been prevented if our society would begin to pride itself on acceptance instead of rejection, inclusion instead of exclusion. Stop making us outcasts. We are a vibrant and diverse community. I think of Kyler Prescott slumped in the bathroom. I think of his mother finding him. I think of the poem he wrote. Not only was it unusually haunting and beautiful for a 14-year-old, it also captured the exact same feeling I had when I looked into the mirror and for so long saw someone I did not recognize. It captured the struggle in all of us. My mirror does not define me, not the stranger that looks back at me, not the smooth face that belongs to someone else, not the eyes that gleam with sadness when I look for him and can only see her. My body does not define me, not the slim shoulders that will not change, not the hips that give me away, not the chest I can't stand to look at when I look for him and can only see her. My clothes do not define me, not the shirt and jeans that would look so perfect on him, but I know would never fit me, when I look for him and can only find her. And I've been looking for him for years, but I seem to grow farther away from him with each passing day. Chapter 2. Just Drop the Damn Ski. It is gym class at my elementary school in Tarrytown. The coach has set up a series of cones in the parking lot. Everybody is going to be timed. Let's get in there and see what we can do. I have never gone out for a team sport in school. I have no idea of my skill level. Frankly, I'm not very competitive. I do things because they are fun and come naturally, And this seems like fun to me. Each of us runs around the orange cones, the coach poised with his stopwatch. He jots down all the times. He looks at me. Classmates who have never given me the slightest attention are patting me on the back. The coach's stopwatch confirms it. I'm the fastest kid in the entire school. So maybe there is an outlet for success for me. And it's not just success as I move up the sports ladder. What better way to prove masculinity? What better way to get rid of this thing? Athletes don't try on women's clothing. Athletes don't walk around the block in a scarf. Athletes parade their private parts in the locker room. We are the Titans. Sports is the perfect cover in the 1960s, the kingdom of the male, specifically the white male, and it is still the perfect cover now. There is no Title IX providing equality for men and women in sports. Integration in college sports is slow and hesitant. As for issues of gender or sexuality, sports are once again the perfect protection. An openly transgender athlete in the 1960s? It is still an underground network. Express yourself, and you run the risk of being harassed or arrested. Stonewall, the watershed event in the history of the LGBTQ movement, when members reacted violently to a police raid of the Stonewall Inn in New York, would not take place until 1969, when I was in college. The raid targeted trans women in what was standard police procedure of the era. Because of a New York City criminal statute requiring 3 articles of gender-appropriate clothing, police took into custody those deemed in violation, whereupon they would either feel them up or make them undress to determine their gender and whether the 3-article rule was being followed. It will not be until 1975, when I am 26, that Dave Coppé, a journeyman National Football League running back for 9 seasons, will tell the Washington Star that he is homosexual after a series in the paper quotes an anonymous gay football player whom Coppé recognizes as someone he once slept with. And that is 2 years after his retirement, since going public while playing would have been career suicide. Even today, there are no openly gay athletes actively playing in either Major League Baseball or the National Football League. Professional female athletes have been far more open about their sexual preference, an indication that the environment is far less hostile and the athletes more honest and celebratory of themselves. I have found my calling because of that race in 5th grade. When I move up to junior high, word is out that I'm fast, and a couple of older kids come up to me one day. So you're fast, huh? I guess. Let's see what you got. Let's race. I am fast, but I'm not stupid. I run home. As a kid dealing with all these confusing feelings, nothing makes me feel better about myself than going out on the football field and clocking someone. It isn't just aggression, but an expression of one's ego. You feel dominant over something and can never let go of it. I was never naturally a great athlete. But as I get older and see how my drive to perform and outwork all the other athletes develops, the decathlon becomes more important to me. While this drive obviously comes from a sense of competition, it also comes from a place of having to constantly purge what is going round and round inside, that the only way to fight inferiority is with superiority. Aware of the status that athletics bestows, I play popular team sports such as football and basketball at Sleepy Hollow High School in Tarrytown. I like them. They are fun. But I prefer situations where I rely on myself. I want to be in control of my destiny, maybe because so much of my life is about control. If I win, I did it. If I lose, it was my fault. I get to walk away by myself. I don't have to commiserate with teammates, or for that matter, celebrate with them. I am a loner, inevitable for anyone who carries inside the secret of themselves they cannot share. I am friendly but still aloof, still at arm's length from everyone else. Because I am good at what I do, people leave me alone. I have friends on the football and basketball teams, but I don't hang with them. People like me, probably because my first car is a 1954 Cadillac hearse, not kidding, and I am able to pack 24 of my high school compatriots into the casket compartment one night. Still not kidding. I don't want people to know who I am, what I think about, and what I grapple with. If anything, I act a little goofy because it puts me further above the fray, the Jenner kid who marches to his own tune. It is not that I cannot feel, but I am scared to. All feelings do is stir up conflict within me. I am on the fringe because I like being on the fringe. It's safer, easier, better. The loner. The sport I like the most is track and field, and the event I like the most within track and field is the pole vault. I pick it up as a freshman in high school. I like the freedom and the spiraling aloneness. There is nothing like running down a narrow lane with a long pole and planting it like a staff into the indentation, arcing in a slow curve before you spring to get over the top. I like that it involves mind and body and lessens the inner turmoil. My dad builds a pole vault pit in the backyard so I can practice. I ultimately become the Connecticut state champion in high school and two-time MVP of the track team. In addition to school-based sports, my dad is looking for an activity that the entire family can participate in on the weekends. He chooses water skiing, so he buys a boat. We all go out on Candlewood Lake in Connecticut. I am scared. Or maybe more accurately, I'm afraid of embarrassment that will only add to my already thick layer of insecurity. I have been embarrassed enough as a child. My dad knows me better than I do and admires my athletic skills more than I do because I don't think there is anything particularly special about me. I'm just a confused kid trying to get by. He knows about the dyslexia, but he doesn't know I like Mom's closet and how that is affecting my self-image as well. And he will never know. Ever. I will never tell him. He will never catch me. That can never happen. Ever. Plus, it's just some weird thing I like for the time being. It will pass, so there is no point in ever mentioning it to anyone. One of his favorite routines on Candlewood Lake is the so-called whip technique. He takes the boat in a circle, the effect of which makes the skier go faster and faster because of the centripetal force created. I scream at him the first time he does that to me at the age of 10 or 11. He keeps on doing it, and I scream some more. My sister Pam picks it up quickly, which only makes matters worse, until it finally begins to click. Then he wants me to drop one of my skis so I'm only skimming the water on one ski. And here we go again. I won't do it. I can't do it. I'm just getting used to two skis. Please, Dad, don't make me try. I can't handle the failure. I have had enough of those in my life. I'm already weird enough. I feel it every day. Please, Dad, don't add to it. He won't let go. Just drop the damn ski. Okay, I'll do it. Just don't say it anymore. Just drop the damn ski. Okay, I said I would do it. Just drop the damn ski. I take the chance. I do it. I feel exhilaration afterward. I go on in my middle and late teens to win the Eastern States Water Skiing Championship 3 times. The victories are sweet, but what I really learn from water skiing, thanks to my dad, is the humility that will carry through the rest of my life. His credo is simple. Actions speak for themselves, not speaking. Let everyone else go out there and perform. Then you do it without a word. Don't even tell them you can ski. Let them figure it out for themselves once you're done. High school is about other things besides sports, of course. I suppose it's about grades, Although my only academic interest is maintaining a C average so I can remain eligible. There is also dating and sex, which goes hand in hand with being a big man on campus. I am a star on the football team, the most popular sport in high school. So going out with girls is the thing to do. But I am shy and awkward and date only a handful, none with lasting consequences. As for sex, guys talk about it nonstop, so I feel I have to go in that direction. Because I both put women on a pedestal and envy them, I am not a stereotypic aggressive male jock. I prefer being on the bottom instead of the top, which in the context of a suburban town in the 1960s is heresy. So I take the top bunk, so to speak, and do my best. I have sex with my first girl when I am a senior at Newtown High School in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, where we moved to in my junior year. It takes place in the backseat of my mom's black Ford Falcon station wagon. I'm ever the romantic. The only thing I remember with perfect clarity is that she is a lot smarter than I am. I do it because I am curious, and there is a definite attraction. And maybe I do it out of obligation to maintain appearances. Everybody in high school knows who has slept with whom, and this is helpful to me in maintaining cover. Unlike many athletes I will get to know in later life after high school, I do not keep a running journal in my head of conquests. It would be a very short scrapbook if I did. I don't have the appetite for it, which is why the public's obsession over my sex life now, whether I will or won't, is annoying to me. It harkens back to this endless misperception that men and women transition because of their sexual preference and desires. They endlessly wonder, if a man becomes a woman and still enjoys sex with men, does that make her heterosexual or homosexual? Who the hell cares? Why must labels be attached to everything? My preference has not changed now that I have transitioned. Why would it? I have always enjoyed women. Not that I think of it a lot. Of the most important things in my life, sex is beyond the bottom. It has been that way for a long time. A future female companion? Yes, I do think about that. A future female sexual companion? Not happening, at least for now, and perhaps not ever. A future male sexual companion? I have never had the inclination. But maybe that attitude might possibly change if I have the final surgery. Maybe removing the last physical appendage of my maleness, or more precisely, maleness as defined by the medical establishment, will make me feel differently. Some would argue that there is no good reason to have gender-affirming surgery as a trans woman unless you are intent on having sex with men. For me, the reason to do it is different. Feeling as authentic as I possibly can. Mostly, I float through high school. I have no burning ambition in sports, maybe because I have yet to find the right event that plays into my versatility. I am good in the pole vault, but not competitive on a national level. The decathlon? At this point, it's just another word I have difficulty spelling. Unlike so many great athletes who come out of the crib ready to go, I am not. I like to win, but competition does not ooze from every pore. I maintain that happy-go-lucky core, so much so that when I make all-county and track and the local paper wants to take a picture of me and other athletes honored, I forget to bring my track shoes and appear in loafers. If there was ever an athlete not destined for greatness, it was me. I do have self-discipline. I am able to shut things out, including my gender issues. They are always there, but in high school they are mostly in check. I still cross-dress when I can, but getting the opportunity is hard, although I have moved up to Pam's clothing since Mom's is now way too small. Just as I admire women, I am also jealous of them. I feel that bubbling inside me, not because of the way they look, but because of how comfortable they seem, and knowing I will never be able to feel that way. Just as I see how comfortable men are, and knowing I will never feel that way either. I feel as if I am of no gender, trapped in the worst place to be, the middle. I remember Ella, she will become a regular on I Am Kate, telling me of her experience in high school, how she made no effort to blend in and just be one of the crowd. She wore her hair purple. She sometimes wore dresses. She made it clear that she was shedding her skin as a boy. She celebrated herself regardless of what other students thought. I so admired Ella's fearlessness. I so admired her acceptance of her true gender identity, not as a curse, but as a blessing and liberation. I wonder sometimes why I didn't do that in high school, just say screw it and set myself free. There were obvious reasons, the tenor of the times, the social conservatism not only of my immediate environment, but of America as a whole. I would have been sent to shrinks who still believed that gender dysphoria, just like homosexuality, was a disease that could be cured using such barbaric methods as electric shock or inducing vomiting while showing the patient homoerotic images. I certainly would not have been able to play any sports. I probably would have been thrown out of school. But perhaps it was all more basic than that. I just didn't have the courage. That's what took me so long. I only wanted to blend in. As I near graduation from Newtown High, the only definite plan I have is to continue my education, which will also grant me a college deferment from the Vietnam War draft. Although I was the MVP of every sport I played at Newtown High for the 5 semesters I was there, basketball, football, and track, I am not heavily recruited. The only place I get any real interest from is Graceland College in Lamoni, Iowa. I am not interested in Graceland. I know nothing about Iowa except that it is flat and cold in the winter. The school is affiliated with the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, known today as the Community of Christ, and I don't know anything about the religion except that it's a mouthful. I have never gone west of Ohio. I have been on an airplane only once in my life. New York City might as well be on the dark side of the moon. I have no hippie tendencies. I am straight and narrow and following in the conservatism of my parents. So my plan is to continue living at home after high school to keep my expenses down, go to a junior college nearby to get my grades up so I can attend a 4-year school, and work for my dad's tree business on the weekends to make a little money. I am kind of aimless, to tell the truth. Maybe a career in mechanical drawing. I don't really know. I have just attended the first day of classes at junior college when I get a call from L.D. Weldon, the athletic director and track coach at Graceland. Hello? Can you be out here tomorrow to play football? Who is this? L.D. Weldon. I coach at Graceland. I don't know. Well, the quarterback we recruited from a junior college is a credit short, so he isn't eligible. And we only have one backup quarterback, so we need somebody else. Okay. Football is still fun to me. Call me back tomorrow and I'll give you an answer. I talked to my parents that night. They cannot afford to send me to college, so I go to the bank the next day and arrange for a student loan since the scholarship is only partial. Weldon calls me, and I tell him my decision. Okay, I'll be there tomorrow. He hangs up. July 15, 2015. Please, God, don't let me trip. I am making my first public appearance as Caitlin in Los Angeles. I am wearing a white Donatella Versace evening gown custom-made by the designer. I have not met her personally, but she has sent emissaries on several occasions to make sure the fit is right. Only one of them speaks English, but if I have learned anything from keeping up with the Kardashians, it is that the language of fashion is universal. I want to look sleek and gorgeous. Scratch that. I need to look sleek and gorgeous. If I come on stage looking like anything less, the behind-my-back ridicule, which you can always hear anyway, will be merciless. If anybody wants to know what that kind of savage mockery feels like, how it affects your self-image at a moment in your life where your self-image is still a blur, hire a swarm of paparazzi and ask them to chase you around from the time you get up in the morning until the time you go to bed at night for the next 10 years of your life. Gowns are tricky when you are not used to them. You can step on the hem and go flying. Good thing I switched into a pair of shoes with a shorter heel to minimize the risk. Actually, since you cannot see the shoes at all, I should have worn a pair of my old shot put shoes for extra precaution. Please, God, you have made my life confusing enough already. Please, God, don't let me trip. It is all I can think about. Tripping when it's time to walk up the small set of stairs to the stage of the Microsoft Theater in Los Angeles to accept one of the most prestigious and meaningful awards in sports. If I trip, it becomes a bigger picture than the one Annie Leibovitz took of me in a cream-colored bustier for the cover of Vanity Fair a month and a half prior. Tripping is not the way I want to be remembered. Tripping would give the paparazzi way too much satisfaction. Social media would hit the jackpot. I also have a great deal to say. It is an important moment for me, maybe the most important in my life besides the birth of my children. The final day of the decathlon in Montreal, when I either would win the gold medal and have something to show for those 12 years of training, or not win the gold medal and go home a nobody with nothing to show for those 12 years of training, pales in comparison. This is my life, not a sporting event. The trans community already has issues with me, and I've only reached my 4-month anniversary. They are fabulous, but some can be tough and critical, frustrating and debilitating at times. I am already hearing I am not representative of the community. I certainly won't dispute that, although such judgment strikes me as hostile and exclusionary and counterproductive to our collective cause, since much of our fight is to get society to remove such meaningless labels as representative. We are all in this together, or at least we should be. But tonight, like it or not, I am the face of the transgender community to millions who have never seen a trans woman or man in their lives. The first impression is often the lasting impression. If I screw this up, I will set back the movement. I will have squandered a rare opportunity on behalf of all of us who are different and should be celebrated for it, not forced underground. Controversy has begun well before the annual ESPY Award ceremony at which I will receive the Arthur Ashe Courage Award, named for the great and gracious tennis star who died of AIDS in 1993. I have been to the ESPYs, ESPN's version of the Academy Awards for sports, many times. It is a huge honor, given my respect for Ashe and others who have won the award in the past. Muhammad Ali, Billie Jean King, Tommy Smith, John Carlos, Nelson Mandela, Robin Roberts. That's the simple part. The fact that this will be Caitlin's first public appearance is terrifying enough. Now add to it that it's an appearance before the world of sports, from which I came. Then add to it the millions watching on television. Do I think I deserve it? Absolutely not. But nobody would turn down such an honor. I am also dealing with a rumor that I was the one who came up with the idea. The scenario goes that in return for giving ABC's Diane Sawyer an exclusive 2-hour interview on 2020 in April 2015, in which I publicly announced my intent to transition, I insisted on receiving the Arthur Ashe Award at the ESPYs as a quid pro quo. The rumor was fed by the fact that the same company, Disney, owns ABC and ESPN. It is 100% wrong, complete bullshit. There is no other appropriate word. The actual interview took place months before I was told I would be receiving the Arthur Ashe Award. But like so many false rumors today, it has jumped beyond the tabloids into such mainstream media as the Los Angeles Times. You would think they might like to check first, given their holier-than-thou reputations. In today's world, be serious. So right at the beginning, there has been negative spin in some corners. Then come several prominent figures in sports saying I do not deserve the award. One of them is Frank DeFord, a renowned writer for Sports Illustrated and an NPR commentator. It was DeFord who wrote the cover story on me in the August 9, 1976 issue of the magazine after I won the decathlon. Jenner has an almost mystical ability to divine his own limits, and those who have been with him at meets say that by studying his opponents as the events go by, he can perceive their exact capabilities that day. Montreal, he felt, was his destiny. Almost 40 years later, the tenor is different. Courage is usually involved with overcoming something. Caitlyn Jenner is being forthright and honest, but this is something that she wanted, and she has a fallback position, a reality show, fame, and lots of money. There's not a great deal of risk involved in the same way that someone who worked down at the body shop would experience. Bruce Jenner had a good idea that he wasn't going to lose by doing this. His family is in support of him. DeFord and I are in agreement that there is no particular courage in my transition. As for overcoming something, the only thing I overcame was knowing I was in the wrong gender for most of my life and being too scared to truly deal with it. I was in the public eye and worried about ridicule and scorn and hatred and condemnation and what the Frank DeFords of the world would think in the context of the 1980s if I showed up for some rubber chicken sports award dinner in a skirt and pardoned myself to go to the ladies' room, assuming I would be allowed into the ladies' room to freshen up. As for the support of my family, they have all been incredible, more than incredible. But it has only been a little more than a month since I publicly became Caitlyn, and every day I wonder what all my children from my three marriages really think, whether they do truly accept me and can still call me Dad, as if it still has meaning, or instead look at me like some quasi-stranger who is selfish to do this at such a late stage in life. It is not a reflection upon them, but upon me. The fear of acceptance I now feel, no matter how outwardly effusive that acceptance has been, waking up in the morning and thinking about gender and the decisions I have made, and going to bed thinking the very same things. As Caitlyn instead of Bruce, I am now a public person no longer in the private shadow. That does things to your head. Doubt, different from regret because I have no regret, is a universal sensation among virtually every man and woman after initially transitioning. Once you do so, you never go back. Never. And every relationship you have will change either because it has changed or you think it has changed. All of which is a way of saying that in my mind, at least there is a lot on the line. My relationship with my family and the rest of my life. The other vocal critic is NBC sportscaster and commentator Bob Costas. Speaking on the Dan Patrick Show, Costas says he wishes me all the happiness in the world and all the peace of mind in the world. However, it strikes me that awarding the Arthur Ashe Award to Caitlyn Jenner is just a crass exploitation play. It's a tabloid play. In the broad world of sports, I'm pretty sure they could have found someone, and this is not anything against Caitlyn Jenner, who was much closer to being actively involved in sports, who would have been deserving of what the award represents. Costas is an excellent sportscaster and commentator. I know how hard it is, having done it. He insists it is not a personal attack on me, and I believe Costas, but it sure sounds like one. The obvious implication being that I am not worthy of the award. There have also been recipients like me who at the time of receiving the honor had performed at their peak much earlier. If he and DeFord want to see what it's like to be a transgender woman or man, even one as privileged as me, they should transition. I will be happy to help them shop. Sensible heels for DeFord since he's tall. Stilettos for Costas since he is rather diminutive. For most of the ceremony, I am in a suite at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel across the street. I don't watch on television because it will only make me more nervous. About 15 to 20 minutes before my appearance, I exit the hotel from the back and go directly into the theater so no one can see me. They put me in a small private room and I practice the speech for what seems the millionth time. What to emphasize, getting the beats right, figuring out the pacing, not garbling or tripping over words. I feel good, but there is still the issue of the steps to the stage. The anticipation is a little like when I ran my weakest event at the games, the 110-meter hurdles, but at least I finished even with a few missteps. I have often used a Booker T. Washington paraphrase, "Success is not measured by heights obtained, but by obstacles overcome." If there is a moment to invoke it, this is it. Abby Wambach, a forward on the United States women's soccer team that just won the World Cup, is introducing me. I meet her for the first time backstage. Hi. Hi. A little brief, but there is something weighing on me. When I come up the stairs to the stage, you have to help me. I cannot trip. Make sure I don't have any problems. Okay, I'll get you up the stairs. I need a hand. Abby is in a tuxedo and I am in my gown. The symbolism of that is sublime, not to mention a photo op too good to be wasted. No better way to visually show how far sports has come in terms of diversity, with a long way still to go. When we get up there, assuming there are no disasters, I want us to turn and hold hands and take a little bow. See? Always thinking, whatever the pressure. They bring me to the side of the stage. I can peek out and see that the place is pretty much packed. Here we go. I make eye contact with a woman in the audience. She gives me a huge smile and a thumbs up. Maybe the reaction will be okay. At the commercial break, there is the weird dance of audience members leaving and seat fillers taking their place. I sneak in and take my place in the audience. I see Diane Sawyer. Had the interview not so accurately depicted what my life had been like up until transition, I probably would be in Antarctica sharing my tale of deceit and destruction with the penguins. I grab her hand and say to her, "This is all your fault." I know this is supposed to be all very serious, but I can't be. It has never been my style. Humor is always the best deflection. I am sitting in the audience when a video comes on showing the cavalcade of my life. I saw it 2 days earlier. It is elegant and tasteful, and I cried when I first saw it. The juxtaposition of Bruce and Caitlin is shocking even to me. How could one become the other and the other become the one? I know that Caitlin was my gender identity at birth, waiting for the right moment to subsume Bruce. But sometimes answers don't quite answer it. As I have said to myself many times, I have had a most fascinating life. I can't watch it now. It will make me emotional again, and I won't be able to give my speech. Abby calls my name to come to the stage. I am next to my mother in the audience, the last person I told of my transition and the hardest to tell, which is why I waited so long. She is 89, and it just isn't so easy to have your son call up on what seems to be a normal day in Lewiston, Idaho, and have him tell you, "Oh, I forgot to mention, Mom, I'm becoming a woman." It wasn't quite framed like that, but it had the same impact. There is no right way to begin a conversation like that. My mother has been remarkably understanding and supportive, although she readily admits to a little shot of something to make my womanhood go down easier. I leave my seat. As I get nearer to those little steps, I go past the rows on the left where my children are sitting. It is the first time in roughly 20 years they have all been together, Not since the 1990s, when Chris and I were first married and they were kids who adored each other just as Chris and I adored each other. There are many reasons for why our extended family fell apart, but at the root of it was my failure as a father. On too many occasions, I let my relationship to the so-called Jenner children from my first two marriages, Bert and Cassandra and Brandon and Brody, slip away. So it is beautiful to see all my family together again, just as it is also bittersweet. I know it is only a moment, one that doesn't even last to the after party. Abby gives me a hand as promised. I do not trip up the stairs. We do our pirouette to the delight of the cameras. Now all I have to do is give the speech of my life. I try not to look at the audience. There are dozens of sports legends assembled. They are my peers. I can't avoid seeing LeBron James and Brett Favre sitting in the front row. I wonder what the hell they are thinking. I always wonder what everyone is really thinking underneath the surface of being nice to me. Are they just saying things to please me but don't really believe a word? Are they lying? I sometimes wish there was someone who could interview them privately. Get down their real thoughts as opposed to celebrity cocktail party kissy face chatter. Do they really think it's great? Or do they really think the whole thing is very, very weird? Is the gown too much, however perfectly executed? Should I have shown up in my Olympic tracksuit? LeBron is a sharp dresser, but Favre often looks as if he just came out of a barn. So I think I have better odds with LeBron. I imagine he digs the Versace label, although maybe not in this particular style. Plus, he is even taller than I am and far more muscled. Out of the hundreds I have given in my life, never have I written out an entire speech. At most, I jot down highlights. I don't like reading a speech because it sounds like reading a speech. But this is different. I collaborate with a writer, which I also have never done before. His name is Aaron Cohen, and we spend several sessions together where I give him my ideas of what I want to say, and he helps shape them. Then we get it down on paper. I need to know exactly what I am going to say here. I cannot riff, which I sometimes do, actually I do it a lot, and suddenly veer off into unwanted territory. I am also going to use a teleprompter. But because I tend to read slowly, I have hated them since my days as a broadcaster for ABC and NBC in the 1970s and 1980s. I need to practice, so I discover an application on my iPad that simulates one down to the size of the letters and the speed. I set the iPad on the cushion of a high kitchen chair and then read aloud as it scrolls through the words. I do this dozens of times until I have it down perfectly. But now that the moment has come, I feel myself traveling back to fourth grade in Tarrytown, sitting there scared to death with sweaty palms as the teacher walks down the aisle like a prison guard looking for the next victim to read aloud. I can hear the snickers of classmates as I stumble, and I have just gotten used to the fact that it's Bruce and Bruce is stupid. My elementary school years can be easily summed up. First one picked for dodgeball, first one to sit down in the spelling bee. I have to fight through it, so I do. I am good at conquering adversity. I did it all my life, although never in a situation such as this. I no longer see LeBron James or Brett Favre. I no longer see my children or my mother. Once again, I don't see anyone, almost as if someone else is giving the speech, and I, too, am a curious observer. The words come out. All across this country, right now, all across the world at this very moment, there are young people coming to terms with being transgender. They're learning that they're different, and they are trying to figure out how to handle that on top of every other problem that a teenager has. They're getting bullied, they're getting beaten up, they're getting murdered, and they're committing suicide. The numbers are staggering, but they are the reality of what it is like to be trans today. If there is one thing I do know about my life, it is the power of spotlight. Sometimes it gets overwhelming, but with attention comes responsibility. As a group, as athletes, how you conduct your lives, what you say, what you do, is absorbed and observed by millions of people, especially young people. I know I'm clear with my responsibility going forward to tell my story the right way, for me to keep learning, to reshape the landscape of how trans issues are viewed, how trans people are treated, and then more broadly, to promote a very simple idea, accepting people for who they are, accepting people's differences. This transition has been harder on me than anything I could imagine, and that's the case for so many others besides me. For that reason alone, trans people deserve something vital. They deserve your respect. And from that respect comes a more compassionate community, a more empathetic society, and a better world for all of us. I get a standing ovation louder in my mind than the roars in the Olympic Stadium when I finish the 1500-meter run to win the decathlon. It certainly is more important. I didn't trip, after all. Chapter 3. Just Take It. L.D. Weldon is picking me up at the airport in Des Moines. I don't even know what he looks like. He doesn't know what I look like. How are we going to find each other? I get off the plane and walk down the stairs. I go into the terminal and look around and feel a little bit like that book about the ducklings in Boston thinking everyone is their mother. Are you my coach? Suddenly, out of the crowd comes a hand. Jenner?
Yeah.
Hi, nice to meet you. L.D. Weldon, Graceland College.
How did you know it was me?
I can always spot an athlete.
That's kind of cool.
Get your bags, Jenner.
I only have two of them.
We throw them into the back seat of Weldon's car for the 75-mile drive to Lamoni. I can't pinpoint his age, but it's obvious his days as a Chippendale, if he ever had them, and I kind of doubt he did, are behind him. He has one hand stretched over the back of the seat, and the other hand on the steering wheel. He's looking at me while he's driving, and he's also talking nonstop. He's also going about 90 miles an hour. It is an amazing feat unless you are next to him and just hoping not to die before you even see the college. LD had built a few apartments in a back alley of Lamoni to house Graceland athletes so they could save some money. Anything that is free is a good thing, so I wasn't about to complain. But I am not sure it would be fair to call them apartments. The entrance is in back through a door with cracks in it so huge you can literally see through it. And when the cold wind whistles through Lamoni, it is like sleeping on the surface of a skating rink. Behind a second door are four or five rooms and a single bathroom. It looks as if LD has converted a storage area, and my room is barely big enough to contain my 6'2" frame. At least there is new paneling. I unpack, which takes about 2 seconds, underwear, socks, a few pair of pants, a thin jacket that soon proves useless in the weather. I go to my first football practice. Although I have played quarterback in high school, I have also played a lot of other positions, running back, a little receiver. On defense, I play safety, and it is my best position. It's a lot more satisfying to hit than to get hit. I can throw the ball 50 to 60 yards without much problem. The greater question is where exactly I throw it. Receivers, in my experience, are often fleeting objects that suddenly disappear. But they need a backup quarterback, so tag, I am it. I take a few practice snaps, and then I drop back to pass, and I throw a perfect bullet right into the hands of Bob Hutchins, who goes both ways at running back and safety and is the star of the team, for an interception. Hutchins is sailing down the sidelines. I angle toward him, and I am quick, and I get a clear shot, and I nail him. An assistant coach named Bill Dudek comes running over.
Oh my God, you're a defensive player. Change his shirt. So I am moved to safety, a position that much better suits me. I adapt easily to Graceland. My only goal is just to fit in. I am a big man on campus, but a minor one. There is no obligation to show sexual prowess. We are playing Tarkio. They line up to punt. I am a little bit behind the line, almost like a linebacker. We put a cross block on to free the middle, and I sail through untouched. I have a perfect dot shot. I am hell-bent. But as I spring up to block the kick, my right knee is extended, and one of their players hits me square on in the middle of it. I limp off the field, and I have the sensation that my career in sports might be over. I try to rehab it, but it goes out a second time during a game of catch, and I know I have to do something. I have suffered medial collateral ligament damage and undergo an operation on January 2, 1969, in Danbury, Connecticut, by Dr. Robert Fornshell. He opens up the knee and puts a staple in to help stabilize it. He wishes me good luck. I received a wonderful letter from him after the 1976 Olympics, in which he said that most of his patients were now dead, so it was nice to see one who was still living and doing well. I, too, was happy about that. My knee is placed in a cast for 6 weeks, and I have already missed 4 weeks of the second semester when I return to Graceland. I can't run track, so instead I have to watch everyone else. I am just trying to walk since my knee is horribly stiff from being in a cast for so long. LD does most of the rehab, massaging, cold treatments, hot treatments. I lay on a trainer's table and he forces my leg down and it hurts like nothing has ever hurt before, and LD being LD voices his sympathy in a distinct way. Just take it. I was used to the mantra because I had often whispered it to myself whenever my gender issues intensified. Just take it. Freshman year becomes a disaster. I have no motivation to stay in school when I'm deprived of the outlet of sports. The only good thing about my knee surgery is that I will most likely flunk the physical if I'm drafted. I am a wanderer once again, aimless in ambition or pursuit. And already a discernible pattern has emerged. The less focused I am, the less I can grab onto something with all my conscious might, the more my gender confusion comes to the surface. I buy a pair of bell-bottom pants, the current style. They excite me with the tight buttocks and pant legs. They are form-fitting, or as form-fitting as any men's clothing ever gets. I get a rush, an excitement in wearing them. It's a silly pair of pants, but that's how desperate I am to feel something, anything. That's how bottled up I am, starved for any crumb of what I increasingly know is my true gender. By now, I always have the urge to be myself and cross-dress. But as a student at Graceland, I have no privacy. Students and professors are always coming and going. And I still don't fully know what is going on inside me, except for my conviction that something is terribly wrong with me. Maybe I am really screwed up. Please just let it be a phase, because if it isn't, I never want to face it. I go back home after my freshman year and work for my dad again. I am thinking more and more that I don't want to return to college, particularly after I am offered a job at Cypress Gardens, the best water skiing show in the United States and maybe the world, headquartered in Winter Haven, Florida.